I suppose some of you have read a book of mine called The Joyous Cosmology, in which I referred to once a very curious experience I had with Hindu music. I happened to have acquired from Timothy Leary some of this extraordinary Mexican mushroom, and I was feeling awful. I'd come back from a trip to the East and was tired, and I had a sore throat and was just lousy. So I took this thing. And at the first, it just felt just terrible. Everything turned into mud. You know what you expect of mushrooms, of fungus, everything fungoid and kind of clammy and ghastly. Well, after a while it all changed. And I found myself listening to this Hindu music. I didn't know what it was, because my host, whose house I was at, didn't explain anything. And I thought, when I listened to this, what kind of idiocy is going on? I thought, you see, my friend with whom I was spending the day is a pretty wild kind of fellow. And I thought he'd put on a tape recording of his and his friend's antics, because they weren't doing anything that anybody's supposed to do. It was like children making faces. You know how they let little go this kind of things that children love to do. They make these awful faces and make weird noises. I thought, this is just something absolutely absurd going on. And then came this dit-da business in the middle of it. So I said, Roger, hey, let me see the album. Oh, I got the case. Here it says, Classical Music of India, edited by Alain Danielou, who is the most scholarly, respectable pundit on the subject of Hindu music. I said, somebody's pulling my leg. No, not at all. Here was this just babbling sound. Not only do the dit-da business, but they also could use their voices like oboes. You know how you could put a clothespin on your nose and do an oboe stunt. And it sounded like this, and it was just this whole kind of business of children just going out of their heads. Well, I listened to this and I suddenly realized that that's what life's all about. And you know, it was the most fantastic sudden recognition that everything in this world is gloriously meaningless and is curlicues, like on ferns. We get mixed up about it because sometimes we think that a play that is going on, when you see a fern, it has first of all the main branch, then it has sub-branches. And out of these sub-branches come sub-sub-branches. And out of the sub-sub-branches come sub-sub-sub-branches. And so you get a fern. So now you could number each of these levels on which things are happening. And you say, well, this is a number 1 level, this is a number 42 level, this is a number 65 level. And you judge events and say, it's good, it's bad, it's proper, it's improper. But what you don't recognize is that you say something is improper because you thought it was a 63 level, whereas really it was 112. And you didn't know, you didn't realize the level the thing was on. So actually, in the whole play of human life, with all its joys and sorrows, its tragedies, its evils, its good, is just something like a fern. It has tumors on it. That means just simply another clan is making its life there. See, a clan of bugs of some kind are living there too. And they're doing their stuff. And they're living off the fern, the fern's living off something else. We're all leaning on each other in one way or another. And I saw this whole thing as this fantastic play. So, in order to get into... Can you get into that state, you see? You get into it by listening to sound. That's one way in. There are lots of ways in. But one of the easiest ways in is through concentration on a tone. Because, you see, this is the easiest way to stop thinking for most people. If you just concentrate on a single sound, it's very easy to do it, and this stops your thoughts. In other words, it stops you talking to yourself inside your head, verbalizing. And the important thing is, if you want the vision of the world as it really is, you have to stop talking. At least temporarily. It doesn't mean that talking is a bad thing. It means it's too much of a good thing. So that if you silence talking and you experience yourself just in the same way as you experience that's what's going on. And it may be going on, you know, in a kind of a way that you call nice, which is, No, it may be going on that way. But so what? Finally, it is that. That's what's happening. And we're all taught by our mothers and fathers to put a value on it. See, when it goes a certain way, the rhythm of life goes in a certain way when we say, oh, watch out, watch out, watch out, watch out, because that may be the end. What will the end be? Clunk. Clunk. What's wrong with that? Things that start have to stop. Things that go on have to go off, and things that go off have to go on. But you see, we get involved by putting a value on it all. Right, now I could say that's bad, you shouldn't do it, but at the same time, getting involved and putting values on it's all part of the game too. Getting hung up, getting hooked. So you don't get unhooked by saying to yourself, I shouldn't be attached. I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't do that. All you do is you see that getting hooked on it is simply another form of it. More nonsense. More jazz. But deeper jazz. So, like you feel you have an ego, that's an illusion. But it's a very weird illusion, see? It's a very far out scene. A person who you might call a square, who's thoroughly committed to the illusions of standard life, is a very far out person because he doesn't know where he started. He's completely lost. But you could say it's a great show to get that far out, to get that involved in seriousness. So when you look at a square who has this determined, set, inflexible attitude, you have to say secretly, you laugh and say, my, you're doing a wonderful job. How far out would you get? So you can learn in this way to love squares. And this is the only way that will ever change anything. You must never condemn the squares with harsh language, because they are very far out people, but they don't know it. Involved, in other words, in the ultimate curlicues. It's like a labyrinth, you see? All life is a labyrinth. It's a system of tubes. And there are tubes within tubes within tubes. And upon the very, very great fringes of this labyrinth, you get all kinds of hothouse growths. Very complicated games. So complicated that the people involved in them are lost. But that's simply a function of being a long way from the center. When a fern or any form of plant expands from its center, what is happening is this. Inside the stems and the stalks and the tubes which constitute this organism, they're all little creatures. And they're going, traveling along. And they're getting out there. They want to go out. Of course, there's always somebody along with them who says, now be careful. Don't you get too far out, because if you get too far out, you spoil the form. Instead of keeping inside the bounds of the fern, you'll just go off into gas. And that would be awful. See, because you're fern, you're not gas. But those little creatures out on the end say, man, we'd like a gas. No? So they want to get way off. But it is a result of the tension between those little fellows that want to go way out, see, and the people who want to stay in, that you get the outline, the clear form of leaf. They're working against each other. But they are working, even though the one thinks it's right and the other thinks it's right. They're both right and they're both wrong. They're both right and wrong. But they do by being both in a counter position like this, they create what we call existence, what we call the shape of the leaf, the form of the fern. So you will find, of course, that some of them are in fact escaping, and some of them are going off into gas, and some of them are not, some of them are staying put. And if there weren't some of them going off into gas, there would be no energy in the thing. You see, all energy is a quality of follow-through. When you hit a golf ball, you mustn't stop the hit at the ball. You have to go like that, see? Right through. So all energies of life have in them a possibility of an excess, of going too far. When you bring up your children and you tell your children your various far-out ideas and the children suddenly believe in them, I'm horrified. No? All kinds of philosophy I've talked about is being believed by children. And they're taking it literally. I think, oh my God, what will they do next? But everybody feels that way in regard to the strength of a younger generation that is coming on. Because this younger generation is energy. See, we think about young people. We have terrible ideas. We think that we know what life is and that they have to be told and that they will learn it from us and be like us. We don't take that attitude when we see the new vegetables come up in the spring. We don't say the vegetables have to be educated to be vegetables. We say, hooray, at last, young vegetables with all the life and energy in them. New meals for everything. So when we see young people come up, say, good gracious, isn't this great to see the human race is still doing its stuff. I wonder what they'll have to teach us. Because wisdom doesn't come from above down. It comes from below up. It's where the wisdom is. Surging into us. The old people, they have a function. But they have it in order to fulfill that function, they have to understand first that they can learn from the young sources. If they understand that, then they can be wise and be teachers. If they don't understand that, they never can. To be wise, you have to, that's the meaning of saying to enter the kingdom of heaven, you have to become again as a child. And finally, to get back to my point, to become as a child means that you do things which adults consider unimportant. There is a wonderful Buddhist character. His name is Hotei in Japanese, Putai in Chinese. And he carries around a bag, enormous bag, in which he collects rubbish, every kind of inconsequential rubbish, and gives it away to children. Because children understand the meaning and significance of rubbish. Something which my father, when I was a small boy, once said, you are a picker-up of unconsidered trifles. Because the rubbish is the most wonderful thing in the world, from the point of view of a child. So, once a Zen master was asked, what is the most valuable thing in the world? And he answered, the head of a dead cat. Why? Because no one can put a price on it. So, in this man, you see, who is wandering around picking up rubbish, all the trivialities of life, who sees leaves floating down in the wind and laughs at them. This is becoming again as the child. In other words, from the child's point of view, the things which the adult considers irrelevant to survival are perfectly important. And so children collect pebbles and colored glass and all sorts of trivia which they consider as precious as diamonds. The adults say, oh, frippery. But they really have the secret, you see. Now, the child, as child, doesn't know how to play the adult's game, which is a power game, and so has to be educated to learn the values of the power game, to learn what's what and what is important. But when he has mastered that game, he realizes it has no rewards. That all the things that the adults thought they were gaining by their power game are, after all, not worth having. That's why you can be rich and miserable. So that having learned and having seen through the adult power game, you come back to the point of the child. And so you say, well, let's have a brief intermission. We'll serve refreshments after seminar. Just let's stretch for a few minutes.